Fred and Jeff and John are the three horsemen. They never get along, they're the three horsemen. They argue about science fiction and fantasy. Fred and Jeff and John are the three horsemen. Ride, horsemen, ride.
Good afternoon, evening, morning, or night. This is the Three Horsemen. Today we have two out of three horsemen, but to make up for the missing horsemen, we have two guests. So please say hello to Mr. Jeff Patterson.
Hi, Jeff Patterson here. Jeff Patterson 11 on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. I'm on all kinds of things. Not much else going on. Oh, the anthology Reliquary that I was in last year will be out as a Kindle edition, hopefully by the end of May.
And let's say hello to our first special guest, who was also our first guest, period, Mr. Paul Weimer.
Hi there, I'm Paul Weimer. As Fred kindly noted, I was the first ever guest on the Three Horsemen way back in the mists of time, and I'm happy to be back on again. I've been on a couple times since. If you go searching through the archives, you can find me on Twitter as Prince Justin with a V. I'm kind of ubiquitous around the internet sometimes.
Paul never met a podcast he didn't want to be on.
This is true.
And finally, last but not least, because he is really the godfather of this podcast, Mr. Patrick Hester.
I want to make you an offer. You can't refuse.
How you doing, Patrick?
That's terrible. That was a terrible, terrible. I'm doing fine. How are you?
Not bad. Yeah. How's the marijuana state?
We're a mile high. It's funny because I live in Aurora, and about two blocks from my house, a gas station, a Shell gas station, transformed their car wash into a marijuana dispensary.
Oh, God.
Oh, Lord.
And then there's a next to them is a auto parts store. And then there was a blank lot. And then what was it? It's one of the national chains of drugstores, and I can't remember the name of it right now. It's not a Walgreens, it's one of the other ones. Mm-hmm. On that vacant lot, someone else built another marijuana dispensary. So we had two on the same block.
And where do they grow all this stuff?
They grow it here.
Okay.
Kitty Corner is a little strip mall with like a liquor store and a Big Five and a Subway, another auto parts store, and a 7-Eleven. And then a vacant lot between them, they started construction on something there. And I told my brother, I'm like, watch, they're going to put in another marijuana place. And he's like, no, they need to put in a restaurant. We need a restaurant over it. It'd be really nice. No, it's a marijuana dispensary.
So now we're getting Brownie Bakery, man.
Now we have three. And I worked at a job several years ago that was down on 6th Avenue and I-25. And to answer your question about where they grow it, there was a grow house right there across the street from where I worked. And, I mean, you want to talk about – they had – higher security there than I feel like they had over at the federal building.
Yeah.
Because it was like you would see these people go in and they're standing in a line to get in because they have to go into a clean room where they strip off all their clothes and they're given jumpsuits and stuff. And they have to kind of step through this whole security process to go in and work on and pick whatever it is they pick. I don't know. I don't know weed. So I'm assuming that it's some sort of horticultural experience. I don't know.
Harvest the buds.
Yes.
I mean, I read somewhere that marijuana production takes a lot of energy because you're using all the lights. Mm. Then, of course, Bitcoin takes a lot of energy to produce all the coins. So Colorado, if they also mined a lot of Bitcoins, become the energy sink of the nation.
What's funny is if you live in a state where marijuana is not legal, but you still smoke pot, you're probably buying weed that was grown in a state where it is legal. Because what they're doing now is like they're renting houses here and building underground grow things, like black market grow things here, and then shipping it all out, which is just tripping me out.
Well, everyone, thank you for joining us on the Marijuana Podcast.
420.
This is the Three Horsemen joint. So
yep, joint. Yep. But seriously, we wanted to have Paul on to speak about some of his experiences as a globe-trotting traveler, and we wanted to have Patrick on to speak about his book, his writing experience, and to tie that into Jeff and his writing experience. So I thought we'd start with Paul. Where have you been lately, Paul?
Most recently, which was last year, I went to Helsinki for Worldcon 75, which was a interesting experience. I had never thought Helsinki as a destination. There's plenty of places I wanted to go in the world. Helsinki was not three of them until 2014, when the Helsinki Worldcon bid got going. Like, well, these people look interesting. They look like they have their stuff together. Okay, I'll support the bid. Okay, I guess I'm going to Worldcon. But that wasn't the only place I went to. You were kind of leading a question, because 2017 was indeed a year of globetrotting for me. Before Helsinki, spring in the Northern Hemisphere, as the 2017 Down Under Fan Fun delegate, I traveled to the national science fiction conventions of both New Zealand and Australia, which means, yes, I went to New Zealand and Australia.
But did you go to Hobbiton?
I did. The way the Down Under Fan Fund works is they pay for expenses related to going and participating in these fanish activities, which means, though, they did not pay for me to get to Hobbiton. But so for reasons I cannot understand, the New Zealand National Convention was not in a major city last year. It was not in Auckland, which you could just fly into and be done with. It wasn't even in Wellington or Christchurch. It was in a tiny little resort town called Taupo. So when I won the Down Under Fan Fund delegation last year, I was trying to figure out, how am I going to get from Auckland, which you fly into, to Taupo? And I came upon the crazy idea of, well, flying into Auckland and then driving to Taupo. It so happens there's plenty of things to see on the way to Taupo, including, yes, Hobbiton. Of course, this also means driving on the left side of the road. Boy, was that fun. Jeff, you have to understand. Here I am. I've just got off a plane in New Zealand. It's raining. It's dark. And I have a rental car. I'm surprised I managed to make it out of that airport alive. But, you know, I did. I went to a beach, looked at a beach, went into Auckland and learned how to city drive. And then the day after that, I drove around New Zealand and wound up in Hobbiton. I also wound up in plenty of other places in New Zealand, in and around the convention. Plenty of sightseeing, but the main focus of the Down Under Fan Fund convention was to go to Lexicon 36, which was the National Science Fiction Convention of New Zealand. It's not a large convention. There's the New Zealand fans are not large in number, but they're passionate and very, very fan-oriented. When they gave out their awards, which is the Sir Julius Vogel Awards, I found it noteworthy that the fan awards were given out and given with greater priority than the actual main literary and movie awards. So the fans in New Zealand are a very intense group, and they welcomed me to their bosom, and I had a great time there as that part of the Down in the Fan Fun trip.
So what is DUF?
Okay. So a little history. So back in the late 60s, early 70s, back in the days where international travel was not a thing, a group of fans in the UK and the US decided to try to send fans from from the UK to the US to promote Spanish activities and see what other people are doing in other parts of the world, because this is in the days before Skype, Google, or the internet. And that was TAF, the Transatlantic Fan Fund. Mm-hmm. The Transatlantic Fan Fund inspired a bunch of other fan funds, including a few years later, DUF, which is the Down Under Fan Fund, which works between North America and Australia and New Zealand. So every year it goes, cycles back and forth. A candidate candidates nominate themselves. They get nominations by getting fans to vote for them. And the fan fund, which is entirely done by donations by fans for fans, sends the candidate to these two conventions on the other side of the world to learn about other fans, learn about what they're doing, and share our love of science fiction. So in 2017, I stepped forward as to nominate myself for the fan fund. I got people on both sides of the Pacific to vote for me. And as a result, I was chosen to go to New Zealand and then consequently to Australia. This year, it's 2018, we do the reverse. So Marley Jane Ward is our 2018 DUF delegate. So she is coming from Canberra, Australia to Worldcon this year in California. And then so next year, we'll do the cycle again and somebody will get to go to Australia and New Zealand or New Zealand again. It's generally Australia, but because the Australia and New Zealand conventions were within 1 week of each other, it was suggested to me early on I might be able to do both, and so I did. But generally, Australia generally gets most of the DUF trips back and forth.
So did you meet anybody of note? Any
friends of the podcast? Well, by odd coincidence, the guest of honor at both the New Zealand and the Australia conventions was a little-known writer here in America named Seanan McGuire. So I wound up basically following Seanan McGuire around New Zealand and Australia for a while before we parted ways. We had meals together. We had lots of good times. We discovered the goodness of meat pies.
Did you sing show tunes together?
I didn't sing, but I heard her sing. Oh my God, she has a gorgeous voice. Yeah, she did a concert at Lexicon, and people were just rapt with attention. It was awesome.
What about Australian personalities?
I don't know what friends of the podcast you want. I meant a slew of Australian writers of all sorts. Kat Sparks, Lariah Dyer, Elizabeth Fitzgerald, Corey J. White. The Australian convention, which was in Melbourne, was moderately sized, was somewhat larger than the New Zealand one, and was mostly Melburnian people with a sprinkling around Australia. Australia is big, and so mm-hmm. they move around their national convention every year to different parts of Australia. And what I've been told is the convention is generally 80% people from that area plus a sprinkling in from other parts of Australia. So this year was a very Melburnian, that 2017 was a very Melburnian convention. This year, I believe it's in Perth, so it'll be a very Perthian convention and so on and so forth. So it was lots of Melbourne writers and Melbourne fans that showed up with some people from outlying regions. I did finally get to meet all three people of Galactic Suburbia. I got to watch them participate, do a podcast live, and they shouted me out on the air. So I was kind of on their podcast in a tiny sense. I also got to read an essay from the now Hugo nominated Luminescent Threads Connection to Butler essay book. So I got to read that at the convention, which was really cool. Bunch of Australian personalities. A science fiction author from Colorado, although now she's living in New Zealand, happened to be in Australia at the time. So I went hiking with her at the very end of my trip. That's Courtney Schaefer. So yeah, I got to spend the night with the then now GUF delegate, because there's the fan fund that goes from Australia to Europe is the Get Up and Over fan fund, GUF, Donna Marie Hansen, and she put me up for the night in Canberra. I was driving across Australia. Yes, yes, I drove from Melbourne to Sydney. Yes, I'm crazy. And stopped in Canberra along the way and got to see the NASA Deep Space Station, among other things.
And how does one contribute to the fund?
Generally, you can just give money to one of the administrators. So I am the administrator of North America until somebody gets elected to do the fund next year. So you can actually visit my website, princejustin.com, PRINCEJVSTIN.com, and there's a link there to just donate straight money. Or if you want to know more about my adventures in Australia and New Zealand, plus maps and more photos than you can shake a stick at, you can buy the Down Under Fan Fund report. As part of the Down Under Fan Fund duties, not only are you encouraged to go to these conventions, meet fans, and talk about science fiction, you're encouraged to write about the story of your adventures and put it up for sale. So for $7, you can get a PDF of my adventures in New Zealand and Australia, which not only include my stuff at the convention, but also my trips to Hobbiton, mountains, rivers, driving across flooded areas, trying to make my way across Australia without a clue, and see all the pictures I took and detail everything I've done in my perambulations and in the Antipodes.
You made it, so you must have been able to read a map or something.
The GPSs in my car were car were very helpful, as was Google. But yes, learning to drive on the wrong side of the road, or the left side of the road, dealing with Australian trucks that, well, were frankly terrifyingly large, and the one point where I came across the flooded river and thought, yeah, I should drive across this, and well, that wasn't the smartest thing I ever done in my life, but worked.
I'm just picturing the Balls version of The Wages of Fear.
I was thinking more the Gods Must Be Crazy.
Ah,
yes, the Gods Must Be Crazy would be a good analogy to some of the things I got myself into. The funny anecdote is I got so used to the controls in Australian and New Zealand cars, when I got home and got in my car, I turned on the car and went to hit the turn signal and hit the windshield wipers by mistake, because I've been so used to them being reversed. It's like, damn!
So you mentioned photographs?
Yes. As listeners of the podcast may know, I'm an amateur photographer, and so When I went to Australia and New Zealand, I took hundreds of photographs. There's only some dozens in the actual report, but I have plenty of other photographs of my travels and adventures. Most of my photography is oriented towards, I go to a place, I see the place, I photograph the place. I do take some macro photography as well, but the occasional portrait at a science fiction convention, but generally my photography is tied to my traveling and adventures. And so at my website, princejustin.com, you can find more photos than you can shake a stick at. And I understand Flickr's been taken over by Smug Mug, and I still got thousands of photos there. You can search for, I believe it's flickr.com/JVSTIN, and you can find even more photos by me, including photos from when I wasn't really knowing what I was doing, and so look rather terrible. Please forgive the quality of some of the early photos. They're not very good.
Any questions, Jeff or Patrick?
I'm just impressed because when you said that one of the topics was going to be Duff, I wasn't sure how long we could talk about the beer that Homer Simpson drinks.
Oh, God.
I don't think anyone's ever connected that with actually the fan fund. I've never heard that joke, Patrick. It's in all
seriousness. Until now.
Until now. And so we got
So I was edumacated.
I mean we could also have a FUD fan fund, I guess. Fans under drawbridge, down drawbridges fund? I don't know. That could be FUD.
Rabbit season.
No, I just remember the Simpsons episode where Simpson gets sick of Duff and goes to another town, and the beard there is FUD, as I recall.
Yep.
So
been a while since I've seen a Simpsons episode, but yeah, I remember that. And it's been a long time since I've seen The Gods Must Be Crazy. So points for bringing that one up.
I've not yet ever been to Africa. I've been to, if listeners go visit my website and look at the post, I have been to Europe, Helsinki, as I mentioned just last year. I've been to Rome. That Rome is probably still my one-time favorite trip, although the Australia-New Zealand trip is really strongly number two. I'd like to see more, but, you know, money and time, mostly money, keep me from traveling the entire world as I might want.
I understand there are a few waterfalls in Africa, Paul.
Yes, there are quite a number of waterfalls in Africa. I would actually like to go up to Kilimanjaro. What I know author Wesley Chu's done that. I'm kind of jealous of that expedition he made.
Oh, yes.
That would be really cool.
And if you don't listen to Paul, I mean, if you don't follow Paul on Twitter and you're listening to this, you should, because a lot of times he will post a lot of photographs of different things, including, you know, cool architecture and places he's been. So he's downplaying how cool his photographs are and being self-effacing when he shouldn't be, because he takes some awesome pictures and he shares them on social media.
Thank you for the compliment, Patrick. I'm really only average compared to people like Sarah Chorn or Jim C. Hines or Chuck Wendig or many of the other people in the scientific community who also take photographs. There's apparently a Venn diagram, and there's some decent overlap there between photo and yourself, of course, between interest in photography and interest in science fiction.
I haven't taken a decent photograph in probably 2 years.
Hey, Paul,
haven't gone anywhere.
Paul, did you get to go out to that frozen island on the lake there this year?
Oh, you mean the ice caves?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the ice never stabilized enough to have the ice caves open this year. Again, I mean, we had a really cold winter, and I kept following the ice cave page on Facebook, the Apostle Islands Ice Caves. This is in northern Wisconsin, listeners. I've been there twice, but yeah, this year the ice never stabilized enough for them to say, yes, we're open, please come in, go. So yeah, I was hoping, because this year winter was relatively severe, is like that we'd have the chance, but no, unfortunately, no. It just never actually gelled enough. I keep watching and hoping, but yeah, maybe next year.
How long of a walk is that from the shore?
To get to the nearest of the ice caves is 1 mile each way. The couple times I did, I just kept going because there's just formation after formation after formation. I did 7-8 miles round trip on both trips. I think actually more like 9 on the first one, because you can just as long as the ice is stable, you can just keep going, because that coast just goes and goes and goes of this sculpted sandstone, this ancient sandstone against the water. I'm not much of a boat person. Maybe sometime I'll find out if there's a ferry or something, I can actually go see this in the summer, which is the traditional way you see these caves. But yeah, when the ice is there and actually solid, yeah, it's a long walk, but lots of people do it. It's easy to you just follow the shore and you're there. So you can't exactly get lost on the ice. So yeah, it's you know, you hydrate, you bundle up in layers, and you go and do it. And yes, listeners, you can find pictures of my ice cave adventures on my website as well.
Cool. So let us turn, I guess, to the next subject, which is writing. And no, this is not I Must Be Writing, but we'll try to do something like that. So, Patrick, Fred. You are a world famous published author with a novel under your belt, correct?
That's kind of you to say.
Well, I liked it.
Well, thank you. And I know it's not your thing, so that means that makes the compliment even better.
So tell us about that.
It's an urban fantasy. It's set here in Denver, and it's called Into the Fire. I wrote it, and people always ask me how many drafts I did, and I don't know because of the way that I write, which we can talk about if you want at some point.
So does that mean you're a pantser versus a plotter?
No. I'm a hybrid in that I tend to pants it first, and then I start plotting things out as they come to me, mm-hmm. and then I go back and start over and plot things some more, and then get to a certain point where I start pantsing again and then start over. And so it's kind of difficult to call myself either one because of just the method and the madness that is the way I write. You know, I'll just suddenly think to myself, gosh, it would have been really cool if I'd had this happen. And then I'll go back and start editing and completely change everything from that point on. And it might be the beginning. It might be in chapter 4. You never know where it's going to happen. And I just start messing with it. And once you start pulling the threads out, the whole pattern kind of falls apart and you have to re-knit it, is the way that I always put it. So, you know, I started writing Samantha Keen. That's the main character. When I was living in the condo, so figure 2006, somewhere around there is when I started writing that book, and just continued writing it over and over and over again and changing stuff and sharing it with critique groups and different people. And, you know, eventually got it published. And I always saw it as a series. I still see it as a series. I started book 2 immediately after I got an agent for the book, and finished book 2 and then started on book 3. So I always have high hopes that I'll be able to get other stuff published in the series. But essentially, she is a character who lives here in Denver. She's a police officer, second generation. She's trying to follow in the footsteps of her father, who's kind of her hero. He's very ill in the book. And in the very first couple of pages, you find out that something horrible has happened. And her body's response to this horrific event was to blast out magic, which she did not know existed, and is having to deal with the fact that somehow she's using magic. And that's kind of one of the plot threads, is how did that happen? How is she using magic? How is magic real? A wizard kind of comes into her life and says, yep, we screwed up. You should have been a wizard from the start. I can't believe that no one found you and trained you, so I'm going to start training you now. And she's like, what? What are you talking about? Now, magic's not real.
People don't know magic exists. Correct. Other than like in the background.
Yes.
Okay.
And there's a few people who kind of sort of know that something weird's going on. But this wizard guy, they just kind of let him handle it. He actually has a rank within the police department. And they just know that he handles the weird stuff, and they don't have to mess with it. Hmm.
So how is book 2 coming?
Well, I had a complete draft of it, but it was too long. And if you have ever tried to write something, you know that can happen. You just kind of push all your ideas out in the first draft. And then you come back and edit it. And one of the problems that I had with the original draft was you didn't really get to the meat until around chapter 10, which is really, really bad. And so I started redrafting it again this year after taking quite a break. And the meat of it happens now in chapter 1. So it's like that long break that I took from the series and from the character really helped, because I wrote some other stuff, including a space opera. And I think that really helped me focus and get to a better place. So I am right now about 60,000 words into redrafting the second book. And my concept was the first book would be urban fantasy. The second book would be epic fantasy. And the first book does introduce the idea and the concept of a multiverse. So magic doesn't come from our world. It bled through from another world. And she finds herself having to travel to this other world really to get trained. And so I'm taking her from Denver to basically your typical epic fantasy world full of elves and dwarves and things that want to eat her.
Okay.
Well, it reminds me a little bit of Edward Lasson O'Leary's series that starts with Awakenings, which starts off as urban fantasy, but there's hints that there's epic fantasy in the background, and we learn more and more where the characters, who they themselves know where they came from, actually came from. So it seems like that's not a common model. The only other author I can think of offhand that actually does that is Barbara Hambly. So it's a wide open field for you to try to make this your own, Patrick. So go for it.
What is the difference between epic and urban, though?
For me,
and is it exclusive? Can't you do both?
For me, urban fantasy means it's a fantasy set on Earth, whether or a recognizable facsimile of Earth. Whereas epic fantasy, and also low fantasy and sword and sorcery, takes place on something that is not Earth. I mean, yes, you can. So yes, if you have magic and is Conan epic fantasy because it sets on Earth, then you start really getting poking at my boundary problems. But epic fantasy doesn't take place on Earth to me.
There are different tropes as well.
Yeah. Did you see that Netflix movie Bright?
Yep.
With Will Smith, which was definitely an urban fantasy, but the whole idea was that its history was actually an epic fantasy.
Correct.
2,000 years ago was when the epic stuff happened.
Yes. Your point? Yes,
that kind of messes up my nice little boundary. Right?
Well, I was just wondering, I mean, one of your favorite series, Patrick, is not Harry Blackstone, Harry...
Dresden.
Harry Dresden.
Harry Dresden.
Harry Blackstone Copperfield Dresden.
Right. But he has, I mean, there's his world of Chicago, and there's magic in Chicago, but doesn't he goes into the fairyland on occasion.
Never. He goes into the Never Never.
Right. So that's an urban fantasy with epic, or is that something different?
I don't feel that that's ever epic.
Okay.
It doesn't use the epic fantasy tropes.
So even though he's the quote unquote summer night and things like that, it's still not epic?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
Because he's definitely using the legends of fairy,
mm-hmm.
and like the darker legends of fairy. And I am a huge fan of Butcher. And I like not only his Dresden books, I also liked his Pokemon books. And
you mean the Codex Solera?
And his steampunk novel.
Mm-hmm.
I think that he is very talented as a writer. But when you look at those Dresden books and the Never Never, the Never Never is it kind of coexists on top of our world. And there are sort of portals to get to it, ways to get in. And that plays off of folklore and how people, if you look at what's the one about the two magicians in England, Mr. Norrell,
Jonathan Strange, and Mr. Norrell.
Yeah, right.
Yes.
Right.
So similar to that, like you pass over into this fairyland, right? But it's kind of on top of our world, or it's beneath our world. That's the other thing. Like there's the underneath,
mm-hmm.
and I just feel like those are different tropes. That's more folklorish. Epic tropes tend to be bigger, on a bigger scale. And you know, if you go back to Tolkien, it's usually elves, dwarves, dragons. If you go into more modern stuff, it's definitely alternate settings, but it's still those same kind of trappings of castles and armies and knights and all that kind of stuff. Does that make sense?
Well, okay, so would it be one detective solving a crime with magic versus going on a quest to save a world or a universe?
Yeah. They both use the hero's journey, but they use them in different ways.
Mm-hmm. I think I saw somewhere a teacher saying that their class had something like, why can't we escape the circle of the hero's journey?
Everybody wants to kind of do that. And if you go to writers' conferences, a lot of times you'll see, or even literary science fiction conventions, you'll see something on the programming on breaking out of the hero's journey, you know. And but then you'll also see something about, you know, how to write the hero's journey or why should you write the hero's journey. Go ahead, Paul.
The hero's journey is a cliche, but it's a cliche because it's a story that speaks to us really deeply. So it's a form and model that is tantalizingly easy to want to emulate because people get that. They understand it. Chosen one, go on a quest, meet companions, defeat the problem, come back. People get that. There's a lot less building up you have to do because people understand those foundations so well and have for centuries.
Yeah, and that's why it works, because it's a blueprint that you can put on most stories. You know, the hero it has a call to action, and they deny the call to action. They say they're not going to do it. And then there's an event that triggers them to say, oh my gosh, you know, I have to do this. So you apply it to Star Wars, right?
Mm-hmm.
Luke finds the droids. And the droids say, we're trying to find Obi-Wan Kenobi. And he takes him to Ben, and Ben's like, you must come to me. You must learn the ways of the Force if you're going to come to meet Alderaan. And he's like, I can't go to Alderaan. I have to go home. And he goes home. You know, he denies it. And he's like, I'm not going to do that. And he goes home. And spoiler, Aunt Beru and Uncle Owen are dead. And
I haven't seen that yet. Come on.
So there's the event that triggers him to now say, I know I'm coming with you and I'm going to do something about this, right? That's the hero's journey. And you can take that template and apply it probably to most things that you have enjoyed, most stories, most movies, television shows, all that stuff. It's that arc. And it's just something primal that as Paul mentioned, resonates with us. And that's why it works so well. And it's funny that, you know, people are constantly trying to break it or get away from it. You know, I've talked about getting away from it, but it still ends up being the thing that really resonates with people and what we like to read and watch.
So do you envision the third book switching back to urban?
Actually, I envision the third book switching to science fiction.
Oh, you did casually mention you wrote a space opera, so you have some tools and tricks that you can take from that experience.
Well, and think about it. So I've in book one, I've introduced the concept of the multiverse. So there are multiple worlds, and they basically say, we know that there are multiple worlds because magic came from one of them. And in the second book, she has to cross over, and there's a limited window of time where she can do that. And time works differently on that world. And so she's there for quite a long time learning and then comes back to our world, and only a short amount of time has passed, which also goes back to fairy and folklore, right? If you go back, a lot of times people have time displacement in a lot of the mythology and folklore. So, and you know, she comes back. I also have the ability now, because I've talked about the multiverse, to introduce some science fictional elements into the next story, which I call Shattered Earth.
I sense a post-apocalyptic bent to that.
Maybe.
I know, spoilers.
So I have planned these things out. I'm not completely pantsing them.
Good.
And you know, via Merlafferty, we prefer Discovery Writer.
Oh, sorry.
The when you talk about, you know, playing with different genres and crossing them and stuff like that, when I did Iron Garden last year, which is in the Fantastic Defenders anthology, they had specifically asked for a fantasy story, which is what I gave them, but the gag was how many actual science fiction tropes can I shove into it and still manage to keep it fantasy. So I have, you know, many worlds hypothesis, and I have active SETI, and I have nanotechnology and all this stuff, but at no point do they do I portray them for what they actually are. I give a magical equivalent to them. So
well, and kind of the genesis for this stuff, and that's a great concept, you know, but sort of the genesis of this is you go to enough writers' conferences and you talk to enough writers and agents and editors, and what I've noticed is they will constantly tell you what you can't do.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't write urban fantasy and science fiction under the same name. You have to use a pen name. Why? Well, because the readers will get used to you writing in one genre and one name, and then if you try to get them to read something else, they won't be happy with it.
Mm-hmm. I keep hearing that, but I disagree very strongly.
I disagree with it too. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think it's true. But it's one of those things, right? It's so ingrained in the industry and in publishing. And, you know, I see it all the time. And I don't get it. Like, if I like an author, like Jim Butcher, I've read all his stuff.
Right.
Because I like him as an author. And I don't, like, he doesn't have to put a different name on it. You know, I'm drawn to Butcher, and I'll read what Butcher does. I'm drawn to Modisette, and I'll read what Modisette does.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I still to this day, I really want to read Robert Jordan's Western.
Mm-hmm.
And it had a very limited print run. It didn't do very well. You'd have to find a used copy, and I know it's out there somewhere. I would love to read that book. Because Robert Jordan wrote it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, Patrick, you have something in common with Jeff that you're both published.
Yay!
Yay! So let's talk about writing groups. Do they help?
Depends on the group.
Yeah, it does depend on the group. Here in Atlanta, here in the horrible city of Atlanta, there's no end to the number of writing groups you can find. There are a couple that have been very useful. There is one called Vicious Circle, which is sort of an open group that meets twice a month, wherein you read your stuff aloud. It's more of an impromptu gathering, but it's very helpful in the fact that it sort of replicates the immediate response that a reader might have when it comes to feedback. And I'm also a member of the Decatur Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror Scribes, which is a wonderful group, which has really helped me with the current work in progress and helped with a couple of the things that had come out last year. And Atlanta Writes, which is another fairly open group, but which is interesting because there's a lot of genre writers in it, but there's a lot of non-genre writers in it. And the piece I'm currently working on now is a fairly deep dive space opera that gets very weird very quickly, and subjecting non-genre reader to that leads to some interesting feedback. But at the same time, they will also point out things about, you know, use of language and various, you know, narrative arcs that they might display interest in that maybe I just sort of had as an aside or something in the background.
Do you find that they also get really good insight into the characters themselves?
Yes, I once, when I was up in Virginia, I was a member of the Loudoun County Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers, and I had done some pencil sketches of some of the characters. And my point of view character is this alien, and I had done a sketch of him, and everybody was like, oh yeah, that's how I pictured him and stuff like this. And about 6 months later, we were very deep into the book, and I did a sketch of all of the protagonists standing together, including the main character. And they all looked at the main character, and they all looked at me with a bit of disdain going, no, that's not what he looks like. And I was like, excuse me? And they were like, no, 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 no. And so I said, please tell me how you're picturing him. And they get very protective of the characters that they like when you're reading them. So even down here, I've had situations where When I workshopped Iron Garden a year and a half ago, they would tell me to really push Igenia Maurer, the sorceress in the story. They would really tell me to push her in certain directions because they thought she was a bit more resilient than I was possibly giving her credit for, even though I thought she was a fairly tough broad to start with. But they edged me towards giving her a bit more weight to bear. Just because they liked her enough. So
interesting.
Thought went through the head and didn't stop. So
if so, when it comes to critique groups and writers groups, it really does depend on the people. And as Jeff was talking about, you know, you get a good crowd and a good group who give you good feedback, and that just changes everything. If you get a bad group and a bad crowd, that can really bring you down hard.
I agree with you there.
And go ahead, Paul.
I have a question for the two of you. Like, as far as writing groups, is it important to have a writing group you feel connected to, or one that's more focused on, say, genre writing?
I would say you can get good feedback regardless. I've been members of open groups, and I've been members of genre-specific groups. You can get good feedback regardless.
Yeah.
Now, both of you work full-time jobs, but both of you are trying to write. So how do you manage that?
I am a night owl, not a morning person. So the idea of getting up in the morning and writing before I go to work is horrifying to me. And I am literally the person who sets the alarm for the last possible minute to give me enough time to roll out of bed, brush my teeth, take a shower, get dressed, get in the car, and go to work. Like, I wait to the last possible minute. So I'm never going to be that person. Like, I've never had the morning routine. I don't get up, get a cup of coffee, you know, watch whatever vapid morning show is on, and catch up on local weather. I never have ever done that. So anything that I do for writing has to be later. I covet my lunch hours to the point where coworkers are, hey, let's go to lunch. No, I absolutely refuse to go to lunch with people unless there's no alternative and there's no way to get out of it without cutting off my arm. And I have very specific places around where I work that know me now. And when I walk in, I don't even have to order. They just start my food.
Wow.
There
you go. I'll walk in and it's like, hey, Mr. Patrick, Hester? Hey, usual.
Here's your table, Mr. Hester.
Is it the usual? Yep. All right, great. And then I'll go off and sit down and pay, and then go off and sit down and start writing. And then they bring me my food and I eat as I'm writing. And there's several places like that now. I think I've got four. So my fifth day, like Friday, is usually the off day where I don't really have a set place anymore and I kind of float. But
wild card day.
Yeah. But on those Monday through Thursday, it's just sit down, and I can usually bang out between 1,000 to 2,000 words in that lunch hour.
Nice.
And that's how I was able to do like 50,000 words on Sam Kane Book 2, which is called Cold as Ice, in a month. Like, I was just writing like a monster. When I come home, my life is a little bit more complicated. And if I get any time to write, it's going to be around 10:30 or 11 o'clock. And that depends on my physical ability, alertness, emotional state at the moment, and mental capacity. You know, sometimes I just want to turn on the PlayStation and blow shit up. Mm-hmm. Here's what bugs me about submissions. And I typically have a massive chunk of whatever it is done before I start submitting it to a group. Sometimes I even have the entire book done, right? And then I start submitting pages. And the submission process can be, I call it, it creates artifacts. You know, well, why is this character doing this? I don't understand. This doesn't make any sense. You don't explain anywhere in here why this character is doing this and what their motivation is. Well, I explained that two chapters back. You just don't remember. And like that wouldn't happen if someone's reading a book, right? If you're sitting down to read the book, you're not going to read a little bit of the book and then take a break for a month and come back and start reading it again. Like, people don't do that.
Right. Yep. Paul, you want to ask any questions?
No, I have only made very minor prods in the direction of fiction writing. I have two small stories published to my names. I just haven't found the time and will to actually put butt in chair. From what I'm hearing from the two of you, in the end, to write, one must write. And if I don't do that, then, well, I won't write. So I need to, if I want to write, I need to write.
Yes. So last night, I'm a little bit tired today because last night I went to the Pikes Peak Writers Conference BarCon. And normally I'm at Pikes Peak Writers Conference, but I'm taking this year off. And the thing about writers conferences is that, and I was kind of talking to someone about this last night. When you decide that you want to write, typically you do it in a bubble. You're by yourself. You're writing stuff. You share it with your mom, and your mom loves it because your mom loves you, or your dad, right? And it's just the best thing ever. And they're just so proud of you, right? And then, you know, you take your precious little writer heart to a critique group, and you put those pages in, and you just can't wait for all the adulation, and then that doesn't happen, and your poor little writer heart is crushed. And that is the huge thing that I think people need to understand. When you go into these writers groups, there's going to be people who are going to crush you, and sometimes it's legitimate because you're just learning, mm-hmm. and you still have stuff to learn, and sometimes it's not because of other stuff. But when we talk about like building up your shields and your armor, and you know, because you're going to have a lot of rejection as a writer, the critique group is kind of where that starts. And you have to be able to accept that criticism that people are going to throw at you. And good groups do it really well, and they'll temper it with, I really like the way this world is structured. I really like your concepts here. I just think that, you know, you need to do X, Y, and Z to kind of bring it home. And they do it in such a way that it makes you, it still hurts, but it doesn't necessarily crush you.
I mean, Paul, you don't write, but you do create.
I do create.
So you probably have similar habits and such.
Yes. And yeah. And challenges and failures. As of this recording, I just went through a significant creative attempt at creating art that turned out the client did not want after weeks of going back and forth and changes, and that went completely pear-shaped. And yes, it currently has kind of taken my heart and done bad things to it. Spindle-fold and mutilated it, you know, so...
Yeah, but that's right, one person.
It's one client, but yeah.
Yeah, clients are idiots.
Well, but you know, but I know when this client actually gets somebody else and actually gets to produce this thing, I'm going to have to cheer and say, "Hey, look, this is great," and then die inside because knowing that, yeah, I failed, and they succeeded. But so I'm right now in a I don't want to create anything because everything I create obviously is worthless sort of phase. So that's where I'm at, listeners, as this recording.
It's probably some Yoda quote we can insert here.
Oh God.
and that kind of brings me to a point that I did want to make. If you're in a group where people are going, "Wow, this is awesome. I love this. Good job." Run. That's not the group for you. It's just not. You need criticism. You need. It's the only way you're going to get better.
I agree with you that you need criticism, but when I submitted the current work in progress to a couple of the groups I'm in, it had already been workshopped once. Parts of it had been workshopped online additionally, and I was deep into the third draft. So if somebody reads it, and even if it's not in their wheelhouse, if they at least say, okay, well, you definitely have the crown.
Well, we've gone from Down Under to Epic Fantasy to writing groups. So I think that's a good place to end part one of this two-part conversation.
It's quite the hero's journey.
Yes, it was. God. The circle of life. Next, he's going to do the theme to Mad About You. Watch.
Mm-hmm.
You see, I do listen to your podcast, Patrick.
Tell me why.
Yep.
I love you like I do. Tell me who.
But you're not doing the drums. So stay tuned for part two, in which we culture and consume. We'll be back.